Hello and welcome to the first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, August 17th, 2025. This is Carrie, your volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona, and we'll begin this first hour with a feature front page article from the Republic on sexual harassment in a Mesa Community College theater. Then we'll move on to some political news, then on to Valley and state news, and then we'll conclude the first hour with news from USA Today, that is national and world news. So our feature front page article today is entitled "Deeply Sad for These Students," with the subtitle, "Actor Says Mesa College Theater Director Seduced Her as a Teen Decades Ago." This is by Robert Anglin. She said he started grooming her when she was 14. When she was 18, they started having sex. He was methodical, calculated, and subtle. He built up her confidence, made her feel special, told her she possessed a rare, singular talent. For 4 years, she said, he played helpful mentor to her willing ingenue. The then 37-year-old community theater director said the high school senior needed to learn how to kiss for her lead role in his 2006 play. He taught her. Private rehearsals occurred in a locked room behind the stage. His advances escalated in her last semester. Long talks turned into long walks and late-night drives. They parked at the Rims, a high school ridge overlooking the twinkling lights of Billings, Montana, where she was born and raised. He confessed his love for her, asked if she loved him. She said he offered her the world and took hers. Actor and singer Tina Scariano said she doesn't know if she was the first student Mace Arser seduced and coerced. She wishes she had been the last. Scariano, now 37, for the first time is speaking out against Archer, a Mesa Community College theater program director who was under investigation after students accused him of encouraging women to strip for a class assignment and of sexual harassment and abusive behavior at the college. She's joined a group of women in multiple states demanding accountability from college officials who turned a blind eye to student complaints. They want to make sure Archer never teaches again. I was deeply sad for these students and to know that this behavior was still happening all these years later. And it was the same behavior that I had seen, experienced, and heard about decades ago, Scariano told the Arizona Republic. This is absolutely horrifying. Archer, on July 14th, said he could not comment because of the college's ongoing investigation. I wish I was available for comment to create a more complete narrative, Archer said. He referred questions back to the college. An investigation by the Republic in May found Archer encouraged female students to undress on stage as part of a required midterm while the rest of the class was made to watch. The Republic also found college administrators for months sat on written complaints about Archer. Leaders, including the department chair of Communication, Theater, and Film Arts, failed to turn over student complaints to school sexual harassment investigators and allowed Archer to remain in the classroom even after the midterm. He needs to never be allowed into a theater space ever again. Certainly not around children, Scariano said. The college needs to absolutely fire him and issue an apology to the students, quite frankly. Facebook group aims to connect victims and stop Mace. The allegations swirling around Archer at Mesa Community College have prompted women from across the country to come forward with stories of harassment. Maddie Brown said she would have been happy never to hear Archer's name again. A theater student from Billings in the early 2000s, Brown said she was once best friends with Scariano and never forgot what he did to her. Brown said she was not targeted by Archer, but for years she choked down her guilt, wondering if she should have done more to protect Scariano and others. So when his name popped up on social media accounts in May, she said she had no choice but to act. Brown and another former student actor from Billings named Kate Riestad launched a private Facebook group called Mace Archer Reckoning to serve as a hub for victims. They invited men and women to talk, to share, to tell the truth, and they made no bones about what they hoped to achieve. Our mission here is to stop MACE from ever teaching again, so that the abuse of young, impressionable women will come to an end for good, Brown wrote on the page. I want to send out all my love and admiration to all of the brave women at Mesa Community College who came forward and finally stopped MACE in its tracks, she said. We've been silent long enough. The Facebook group has grown to 87 members since June 11th and has resulted in a handful of posts that read as trauma testimonials. One woman said Archer physically objectified her at 16. Another linked to a June 16th TikTok video from a Mesa Community College student who said Archer made our lives hell. Brown and Riestad were part of a tight-knit group in Billings connected to a community theater that Archer and his wife at the time started in the 1990s called Venture Theater. They said Archer used his position to prey on young women, which created an environment for other men involved in the theater to do the same. Mace had a type, Riestad said. Mace liked ingenues. He liked girls who were very sweet and innocent, like Tina. Archer also liked to flex his power, she said. Theater kids who came into conflict with Archer would find themselves unable to get parts or replaced on casts. They were ostracized from a key venue that served as a feeder to the local university and was responsible for summer theater production, she said. Mace did not ever try to hide that he would use his power to get what he wanted, Riestad said. That included doing whatever he wanted to any young girl. Brown and Riestad said they want the Facebook group to serve as a bridge to connect men and women from Archer's past and present, to reach students from colleges and theaters where he often taught for just a couple of years before moving on to the next one. Mace created an environment where this happened over and over again to a lot of young girls, Riestad said. Mesa students track sexual harassment claims. About 1,000 miles away at Mesa Community College, musical theater student Suzanne Olson had spent more than a year trying to connect classmates who privately complained about Archer harassing them sexually or otherwise. Several students spoke to the Republic about their experiences in Archer's classes. In interviews, they said he touched them inappropriately, flirted openly, and steered their performances into uncomfortable sensuality. He seemed to target mostly the younger teenage girls, especially when it came to stripping for the midterm, student Gabrielle Monroe said. Like others, Olson said she feared speaking out. Word was if you complained about Archer, you would be singled out for retaliation. And his acting classes were required for theater students to graduate. Archer never assaulted or touched her, Olson said, but he did plenty to make her uncomfortable, all of it sexual. Incidents stacked up, she said. He peered down her blouse, commented on her clothes, her looks, offered to take her to lunch, showed up at her work just to talk, and called her his favorite musical theater student. Olson changed her routine, was careful about how she dressed, and avoided being alone with Archer. She knew other students who had it worse, she said. They talked quietly among themselves, too scared to say or do anything official. But in 2024, Olson started taking notes. She was attending a theater festival in Southern California and hanging out with about 8 other students between rehearsals when they got to talking about the ways Mace had made us uncomfortable. Olson created a document file for students to share. The stories, mostly anonymous, were blunt, crass, and disturbing, she said. Former and current students alleged he inappropriately touched and caressed them. They said he used the excuse of performance demonstrations to straddle one woman and to wrap his legs around and spoon another. A student said he encouraged her to dive into sexual assault and abuse experiences. Another said he showed a video of an orgy with multiple instances of oral sex. They said Archer seemed to revel in their discomfort. For almost a year, I was the only one who worked in the Google document, said Olson, who graduated in the fall of 2024. I was the only one who wrote in it. That changed in March, when students heard rumors the college was investigating Archer over a sexual harassment complaint. It gave them hope Archer could be held to account, Olson said. The Google Doc grew to 8 pages, with more than a dozen former and current students adding to it. Olson sent a copy to college administrators along with a statement calling Archer harmful and inappropriate and requesting his immediate removal. Then the investigation was dropped, she said, or at least that's how it appeared. Olson said there was no immediate follow-up inquiry into the Google Doc. Archer continued teaching. And that same month, students in his Acting II class met at the college's Black Box Theater for their midterm. The assignment required them to confront their fear and vulnerability. At Archer's direction, students said, three women stripped, two down to their underwear, while another removed all of her clothes. The school was really screwed up, Olson said. Professor praised by school president as complaints rolled in. Personnel records obtained by the Republic show administrators were bestowing accolades on Archer at the same time students were accusing him of sexual harassment. College officials said they launched a formal investigation of Archer in March upon receiving concerns, but they did not define its scope and it has not resulted in discipline, records and interviews show. That investigation is part of a confusing, often conflicting timeline offered by college administrators to explain their handling of complaints against Archer. Archer was officially notified June 25th he was being placed on paid administrative leave. The move occurred after administrators failed to report a February sexual harassment complaint to school Title IX investigators who are charged with looking into such allegations. Administrators said the issues were reviewed through our established process. Allowed Archer to remain in the classroom during the investigation, even after the midterm stripping exercise in March. When the semester ended in May, administrators announced Archer would not resume teaching until the March investigation was complete. Continued to list Archer as an instructor in the fall semester catalog students were using to enroll in classes. The catalog changed May 23rd and listed the instructor as staff after inquiries by the Republic. Confirmed a Title IX sexual harassment investigation was launched around May 29th after Archer was barred from teaching pending the outcome of the previous investigation. Administrators said the Title IX investigation was prompted by new information received after recent media coverage. Whatever investigation the college undertook in March did not prevent Archer's contract from being renewed or interfere with his $112,000 annual salary. Teacher performance evaluations are based on student feedback and peer reviews and are not influenced by investigations unless formal findings result in employment action, officials said. Mesa Community College President Richard Daniel commended Archer in an April 29th letter for his commitment to excellence and extended his teaching contract for a fifth year. Your dedication to MCC is evidenced in the feedback from your students, department chair, dean, and your faculty peers, Daniel wrote in his endorsement letter. That's not the kind of feedback musical theater student Taya Moore gave administrators when she warned about Archer in February. Moore, in a February 20th email to theater department chair Puvana Ganesan, accused Archer of sexualizing her performances, touching her and other women in ways that made them uncomfortable, and making inappropriate remarks about their clothes and appearance. Moore said she was afraid of going to class, and in a series of exchanges with Ganesan detailed specific instances where Archer might have crossed the line. Ganesan initially expressed concern in the email show. She promised to meet with Archer and to look into the learning objectives of acting and stage courses. But Ganesan didn't appear to take her complaints seriously, Moore said. After Moore dropped the class, Ganesan sent a March 6th email saying she was sorry, but sometimes we experience discomfort that can be too great to continue. Nothing in Archer's personnel file indicated the college made any findings based on Moore's complaint. Investigation documentation does not appear in a personnel file unless it results in an employment-related action, said Lindsay Wilson, a spokesperson for the Maricopa County Community College District, which oversees Mesa Community College. Wilson confirmed Moore's complaint wasn't reported to Title IX investigators, a reference to federal laws that require schools receiving federal funds to protect against sex-based discrimination, including sexual harassment. Title IX investigators for the first time interviewed Moore and Olson after the Republic detailed Archer's history of complaints May 28th. Moore said investigators told her they were previously unaware of what she had reported. Moore recapped what she had told Gainesan and promised to cooperate. She said administrators could have prevented Archer's midterm if they had acted sooner. Olson said investigators were warm and compassionate, but also honest that their review might not lead to Archer's dismissal or any discipline. Moore and Olson praised Mesa Community College's theater program as vital and dynamic. They said it provided them with opportunities they wouldn't have had at other colleges. "If I could change one thing about MCC, it would be Mace Archer," Olson said. "He is a black hole, and he is dragging the school down with him. Scion of a powerhouse Montana family." Archer comes from a high-powered, politically influential Montana family. His father, Jerry Archer, retired as Billings police chief in 2005 after 32 years with the department. His aunt, Judy Martz, was a former Olympic speed skater who in 2001 was elected as the state's first and only female governor. Archer pursued drama outside the political theater. His stage career started in Billings, where he achieved a notable level of stardom before his career and personal life imploded over allegations tied to his relationship with Scariano, his 18-year-old student. Archer's background was pieced together from interviews, social media pages, news articles, and the resume and cover letter he submitted when he applied at Mesa Community College in 2021. Archer will turn 57 in August. He obtained a master's degree in fine arts from Illinois State University in 1995. Then he returned home to teach theater at Montana State University, Billings. Archer resigned after 4 years to concentrate full-time on building Venture Theater, which he said he founded during graduate school. A website documenting the history of Venture credits Archer's then-wife, Lisa Fox, as the founder, together with a handful of friends and family. It makes no mention of Archer. Fox, head of musical theater at Western Illinois University, did not respond to repeated interview requests. Venture built its reputation on productions that were not afraid to confront audiences on subject matters that might cause them not only to squirm in their seat, but to question their prejudices and fears, according to the website. Venture's first performances were held in a college theater. It evolved from cabaret performances in bars and restaurants to a makeshift stage in a garage. In 2000, it hosted its first youth summer theater school. Fox and Archer continued running and expanding Venture until their 2007 divorce. Archer's divorce filing makes no mention of Scariano. "I led the theater from an itinerant theater company, performing in a variety of found spaces, to opening a new performing arts facility with 2 theaters, 4 classrooms, and shop facilities," Archer said in his cover letter. Archer did not elaborate on why he left Venture, saying, "Following this period, I spent 4 years as a freelance actor and director working all over the country." He returned to teaching but continued moving around the country, taking posts at schools and theater venues in Tennessee, Kentucky, Georgia, Oregon, and Virginia. Archer in 2008 was hired as play director at the University of Tennessee, according to his LinkedIn page. 2 years later, he was named assistant professor at Randolph College in Virginia, then an artistic director at Mount Hood Community College near Portland. He directed several plays at Arizona Broadway Theater from 2008 to 2014, including Peter Pan, Phantom, and Annie Get Your Gun. When he applied to Mesa Community College, he emphasized his work with diverse populations and how at Venture we embraced LGBTQ+ work and artists well before the mainstream acceptance of such themes. He said he looked forward to spending the next several decades collaborating with the college. Archer in May left Mesa and returned to Montana, where he was hired to perform in 2 summer plays. Directors of the Fort Peck Summer Theater said Archer willingly stepped down on June 5th after being approached about the sexual harassment claims leveled by students. "We do not take this lightly," the theater's executive director told the Republic. "We felt that immediate action was necessary." Teacher-student relationship was no secret in Billings. If sexual harassment allegations were the ripples spreading out from places Archer worked, then Scariano was the stone in the center. The kissing lessons led to assignations, lies, and behavior that Scariano said damaged relationships with her family and friends and wrecked Archer's standing in the community. Scariano was with him for 5 years, during which time he isolated her from those she loved and subjected her to intense emotional abuse, she said. He used to make her lie naked on a bed while he inspected her body for imperfections, referring to her as his sweet damaged goods, she said. The age of consent in Montana in 2006 was 16, and there was no indication Archer did anything illegal. But his relationship with a student raised concerns among some. The Republic interviewed several people from the Billings area who knew Archer and Scariano and talked about their relationship. They said it was common knowledge that Archer was involved with Scariano. Those included former Venture students, actors, past associates of Archer, and friends of the Scariano family. Scariano has since made a career out of musical theater. She toured the country as a lead singer of the group A Band Called Honalee, and in 2020 launched a one-woman show called Feels Like Home, celebrating the queens of 70s folk rock. She also co-created and hosted the self-help and wellness podcast Obsessed with the Best. She recounted her experiences with Archer in a 2023 podcast about cults, grooming, and sexual assault, although she did not name him. She confirmed to the Republic in June she was talking about Archer in the episode. What happened at Mesa Community College convinced her to stop protecting his identity, she said. I met Mace the summer before my freshman year of high school, Scariano said. I took the summer theater camp, the conservatory camp that they ran. I started taking classes at Venture Theater, and I started performing in shows, and I joined the improv troupe. Archer took her under his wing and made her his special project. She said she saw Archer as a mentor and idolized him as a teacher and role model. She was flattered by the attention he gave her and believed the words with which he filled her head. I was having a great time. I was being treated like an adult. I was being given all of this. You're so mature, you're special, you have something others don't, she said. It felt really good that the coolest guy in town was giving me attention. She now has a word for such attention. Grooming. It was very gradual and very slow, but very intentional, she said. Scariano described her upbringing as small-town idyllic. Her parents were traditional and conservative. She didn't go on dates, she didn't party. Her life was centered on theater and school, in that order. She said her first kiss occurred on stage in her sophomore year. I was in Bye Bye Birdie, and I had to kiss Conrad Birdie, and it was like a whole big thing, and I pecked him on the lips, she said. That was the extent of my sexual life. Then Archer cast her in his 2006 production of the musical satire Urinetown. He cast himself as the leading man. The script required them to kiss. So he said, "You know, you're not experienced and you don't know how to do it, so I need to teach you how to do it," Scariano said. And we, all under the guise of theater and rehearsal and art, he took me into a private room and we practiced kissing for this show. I was enmeshed and so brainwashed. The kissing didn't scare or worry her. It didn't trigger alarms in her head. Scariano said it thrilled her, something she still feels guilty about nearly 20 years later. "That's part of my shame that I carry," she said. Sex came shortly after graduation. Another first, Scariano said. She believed it when Archer told her their ages didn't matter, that they could be together despite his marriage, that love didn't respect convention, she said. He said, "Are you in love with me?" And I said, "Well, yeah." And I immediately said, "I feel like I just aged like 10 years. I feel I just grew up a whole lot," Scariano said. And that's when everything shifted. My favorite person in the whole world changed the entire dynamic of our relationship. Overnight, Scariano said she became the keeper of secrets, a betrayer to her mom and dad, her friends, classmates, Archer's wife. But she said Archer had primed her. She was convinced her parents were her enemies, evil, and didn't want what was best for her. Rumors abounded in the theater community. Her friends whispered. Her parents, of course, suspected. They once confronted Archer and his wife in a school parking lot, Scariano said. Fox defended her husband, Scariano said. Lisa shared that things like this happened to Mace all the time, that he was accused of this kind of behavior all the time, and it's nothing to be worried about, she said. Scariano said she was terrified of being caught, even as her relationship with Archer intensified over the summer and after she left for college in Ohio. They were outed in the fall of her freshman year. Scariano said she and Archer spoke each night, all night. He wanted to know everything she did, where she went, who she met. She was happy to tell him, she said. Her parents were on the receiving end of the phone bills. Scariano said her mom appeared on campus one day, drove up in a rental car, told her to get in, and took her to a coffee shop. Meanwhile, in Billings, her dad arrived on Archer's doorstep. Scariano said she confessed everything to her mom. Archer hid in his house from her dad. Her parents tried to talk her out of the relationship. There were fights, arguments, and counseling. Scariano told them she was in love, that it was forever. Scariano said a therapist advised her parents they were in danger of losing their daughter. They were smart enough to listen and begrudgingly accepted the relationship. Scariano went back to college. Archer continued living with his wife. They talked on the phone, visited on breaks. I was so naive. It didn't dawn on me that he was still sleeping in her bed, honestly, when I was in college, Scariano said. I was enmeshed and so brainwashed that all of this was okay. He told me it was all okay and this was fine, she said. That sounds so insane now, but in my brain, it didn't like occur to me how bad this was. Just one in a line of victims, actor says. Scariano said her reckoning came in 2011 when she moved in with Archer and the flames of their long-distance love talk guttered into ugly reality. He was divorced and had taken a job teaching at Randolph College, an all-girls school in Virginia. She had graduated and had just finished a stint performing on the Disney Cruise Line. Once we were actually in a relationship, I felt a whole hell of a lot less special, Scariano said. Scariano said Archer seemed resentful of her and made her feel like an intruder in his life. She said he left her isolated in their rental while he taught during the day, without a car and with nowhere to go. When he was home, she said he made her submit to body inspections. She said she felt worthless, ugly. They did go out sometimes. They took a 2-week vacation to Europe. She said the trip was terrible, but tried to muster enthusiasm for their relationship. On the way home, she told him he made her happy. I just said, you know, this has been the best summer of my life being with you. Was this the best summer of your life? And he said, well, I've had lots of summers, she said. Scariano suspected he was seeing other women and said she confronted him about it. I was always told that I was sensitive and insane and too nosy and, you know, crazy, she said. She said Archer frequently met women. He regularly invited women to their home for something he called Bread Club, where he baked bread and sat with them in a kind of offbeat coffee klatch. Scariano said she wasn't encouraged to participate. He did encourage her to do chores, she said. She was taking out the trash one day when she decided to leave him. I was standing on the porch in Virginia, and it was hot and it was muggy, and there were gnats all around me, she said. I just froze in my tracks, and I was like, this can't be my life. This is not my life. She planned her exit, then called her mom for help. She was 23. She said she had forgotten who she was and who she wanted to be. I remember telling my mom, like, I don't even know if I really like theater, if I just liked it because he liked it, she said. I didn't know who I was. I had no identity. I was lost. And I really felt like I reverted back to this, like, teenager. She left with 2 bags. Archer got rid of everything else she owned and made sure she knew it, she said. Recovery took years of therapy and antidepressants. She said her relationship with Archer affected her later relationships. She is now engaged to be married. Scariano said she hopes opening up about her pain and trauma makes a difference in Mesa. She is only one of many victims who did not fight back, she said. I admire these students at Mesa Community College for sticking up for people who haven't had a voice, including myself, Scariano said. This is their story. They've done this. I want them to get the justice they deserve. And that feature article was entitled Deeply Sad for These Students, and that was by Robert Englund. We're approximately 30 minutes past the hour in this first hour of the Arizona Republic. for Sunday, August 17th, 2025. We're going to move on now to some political news with an article entitled Seven Dems Vying to Lead the State Party. This is by Mary Jo Pitzel. Arizona Democrats will hold a rare midterm election for a new chair in September after removing the leader they had elected at the start of the year. Seven candidates, ranging from a former state lawmaker to community organizer to the man who filed the lawsuit to keep Kanye West off the 2024 ballot in Arizona, are vying for the post. The September 13th meeting will again convene Democrats, 2 months after they ousted former chair Robert Branscum II. Branscum had lost the support of the state's top elected Democrats, and his six-month tenure was marked by a series of missteps and a drop in fundraising. The election will happen just 11 months before the August 4, 2026 primary elections, in which all statewide offices, all 9 congressional seats, and all 90 legislative seats will be on the ballot. On August 16th, the Maricopa and Mojave County Democratic parties are hosting a virtual candidate forum for the estimated 700 state committee members who get to vote on a new chair. Here's a rundown of the candidates. Rashawn Clayton, a union organizer and vice president of the Communication Workers of America Local 7050, Clayton was elected the state party's equity moderator earlier this year. He leans on his union experience, emphasizing the importance of solidarity within the party. He made national headlines in 2020 when he was the plaintiff in a lawsuit to block rapper Kanye West from the Arizona presidential ballot. The complaint successfully argued that West failed to show procedural steps to get on the ballot, thereby disqualifying him. He is also president of the A. Philip Randolph Institute of Phoenix, an organization of African-American trade unionists advocating for social, labor, and economic change through legal and legislative means at both the state and federal levels. Charlene Fernandez, a four-term state lawmaker who represented Yuma, Fernandez most recently served in the Biden administration as rural state director for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Having taken office in the 2020 wake of the first Trump administration, Fernandez told the Arizona Republic she learned a lot about changing cultures, something she said she can navigate as the state party regroups from a divisive internal leadership dispute. She said she would focus on the key issues of fundraising and voter registration, with an emphasis on engaging more rural voters. If we could bring the registration percentages up even 2% more, that would help our statewide candidates, she said. The party has seen a steep decline in voter registration since 2024, registering far fewer voters than the GOP, the No Labels Party, and voters who deem themselves independents. Julie Ferrant. She is the co-founder of the Rural Organizing Initiative, which launched in 2023 with the goal of promoting participation in democracy by organizing rural voters. She also is the environmental justice organizer for Rural Arizona Engagement, a nonprofit focused on civic engagement and voter registration. A Cottonwood resident, Ferrant sees the party's internal turmoil as an opportunity to rebuild the party from the ground up. Discourse is healthy, and a lot of people have expressed a lot of strong opinions recently, and that shows that people care, she told the Republic. She wants to build on those passions as she seeks to push voter registration efforts and amp up volunteer efforts by ensuring that people are given meaningful tasks, not just busy work. Les Myers. Myers is a precinct committeeman from Goodyear. He worked with the White Tanks Conservancy to create a nature conservancy area for this mountain range on the western edge of the Phoenix metro area. He did not return a call to discuss his candidacy. Channel Pau. Pau has a record as an activist in the education, energy, and community engagement arenas. The Phoenix resident is a former member of the Balls Elementary School District Board in Southwest Phoenix. She currently serves as a fellow with the Elected Officials to Protect America, a national environmental protection organization that works to promote energy solutions to lawmakers and policy leaders. She is running as a unifier, touting her ability to turn challenges into progress. In her campaign for party chair, Powell said she would run bold voter registration efforts to build the party up from the grassroots, precinct by precinct. Now is the time to dig in our heels into our shared values, re-energize our base, commit to year-round organizing, and register more Democratic voters, she wrote in a recent Instagram post. Joshua Polacek. Currently a vice chair for the state party, Polacek said he is building his campaign around one-on-one talks with as many of the 700 state committee members as he can reach. He points to 17 years of service with the U.S. State Department as evidence of the professionalism he said he would bring to the chair's duties. He said he managed staffs of up to 30 people and budgets worth millions of dollars during his various foreign deployments. Like other candidates, voter registration is a key goal. Polacek said he would advocate for more attention to rural voters, but also focus on the areas where Democrats already have an edge, such as the urban areas and the tribal nations, to strengthen the party's numbers. Polacek ran for the Arizona Corporation Commission in 2024, but lost. But that experience took his campaign to all 15 counties, something he said the Democratic Party would do if he is elected chair. Shante Rothschild. Rothschild is touting her experience at various levels of the Democratic hierarchy as she campaigns for party chair. Currently, she is a vice chair of the state party, a vice chair for the Pinal County Democrats, and the second vice chair for Legislative District 16, which runs from the southern edges of Maricopa County into northern Pinal County. In her campaign materials, she promised to bring a campaign organizer's mentality if elected. That means having a strategic plan that relies on digital messaging as well as old-fashioned door-knocking. She is not a stranger to the campaign trail. She won election to the Maricopa Unified School District Board in 2024. A queer mother of three, Rothschild said she understands the importance of representation. If elected, she would build bridges between the party's various factions. And that article was entitled, Seven Dems Vying to Lead the State Party. That was by Mary Jo Pitzel. Now, in some Valley and State news, we have an article entitled, Multiple Calls to 911 Made Prior to Girl's Death Are Released. This is by Ray Covarrubias, Jr. 911 calls released to the Arizona Republic by the Navajo County Sheriff's Office reveal what led up to the hospitalization and eventual death of Rebecca Baptiste, 10, after being found unresponsive in rural eastern Arizona. Rebecca was unresponsive when she was found at the intersection of State Route 77 and U.S. Route 180 in Holbrook in northern Arizona, July 27th, according to a news release from the Apache County Sheriff's Office. That same day, a woman called 911 to report she was taking her daughter, later identified as Rebecca, to get medical treatment after she said the girl ran away and was having difficulty breathing. Here's what was learned from the 911 calls that described the moments before Rebecca was taken to the hospital. How did Rebecca Baptiste die? The girl had a severe injury and was taken to the Little Colorado Medical Center in Winslow, about 30 minutes east, according to a news release from the Apache County Sheriff's Office. The girl's exact injury was not disclosed. Rebecca was then taken to Phoenix Children's Hospital and would die there July 30th, the news release said. Her exact cause of death remained under investigation, according to the news release. What do the 911 calls reveal? On July 27th, a woman called 911 to report she was taking her daughter to a nearby emergency medical service station in Holbrook after her daughter was found unconscious and having difficulty breathing, according to the 911 calls. We're headed to the 180. We're getting off our dirt road now, the caller said in the first call. The 911 operator then asked what is wrong with the girl. She has ran away. This is like the third time now. She still hasn't even bounced back from the first time when the neighbor found her. They said she was almost gasping, the caller said not long before the call was disconnected. In the second call, details are again repeated. We're hauling ass to Holbrook to the EMS station, the woman said. When asked again what happened, the woman stuck to her story. She ran away for the third time in a week in the desert. The neighbor found her in a wash. She was unresponsive completely, and by the time she got back to the house, she was barely breathing. "So I'm breathing for her now," the caller said. The dispatcher questioned how the woman was able to breathe for the girl, according to the 911 calls. "I'm putting my mouth around hers and breathing in and out for her," the caller said. The caller asked the 911 operator if they should continue driving to an EMS center in Holbrook, but the operator insists they pull over and await an ambulance, according to the calls. During a third call, the caller said they were stopped by a gift shop. The 911 operator asked the woman if she knew CPR. "Yes, I do, unfortunately," the caller said. The caller questioned why the 911 operator wanted her to put the child on the ground, according to the call records. The operator explained it was for the woman to do CPR. Ambulance sirens can then be heard arriving before the call ended. Who has been arrested in connection with the girl's death? Anisha Woods, 29, and Rebecca's father, Richard Daniel Baptiste, 32, were arrested on suspicion of murder and child abuse, according to the release from the Apache County Sheriff's Office. The two were accused of first-degree murder, kidnapping, and three counts of child abuse in connection with Rebecca Baptiste's death, the release said. Woods, Richard Baptiste, and Rebecca Baptiste all lived at a property in the rural community of Hunt, which is about 40 minutes southeast of where the original call for service was located, according to arresting documents. Both Richard Baptiste and Woods' names were listed on the 911 call dispatch report the Apache County Sheriff's Office provided to the Republic on August 12. The Sheriff's Office confirmed Woods was the person who made the calls in an email to the Republic on August 13. School reported abuse. Child Safety Department responds. Rebecca Baptiste's uncle, Damon Hawkins, told the Republic he believed the Arizona Department of Child Safety failed the girl. "The young girl died to a senseless act of violence," said Hawkins, who organized a GoFundMe to support her funeral costs. He called Rebecca Baptiste a light who loved to draw and had an infectious laugh. "The Department of Child Safety was in and out of Rebecca Baptiste's life for years," Hawkins said. Her parents lost custody of her due to drug abuse several years ago, according to Hawkins. Richard Baptiste later regained custody of his daughter and her two younger brothers, Hawkins said. Rebecca Baptiste's mother was not in the picture, according to Hawkins. The department placed Rebecca Baptiste's younger brothers in a temporary placement home, according to Hawkins. The Department of Child Safety acknowledged Rebecca Baptiste's death with a heavy heart in a written statement to the Republic. "The department was actively collaborating with law enforcement in a joint investigation to ensure that the people responsible for this heinous act are brought to justice," Arizona Department of Child Safety spokesperson Darren Duranko said. Officials at Rebecca Baptiste School believed her death could have been prevented. Over the past year, school staff made 12 reports of suspected abuse and neglect to the Department of Child Safety, Empower College Prep Executive Director Brian Holman said in a written statement. The department told the school that her case was assigned to an investigator on at least four separate occasions, according to Holman. The Child Safety Department disputed that number and said that it received 5 reports from the school over the past year and investigated 1, Duranko said. And that article was entitled, "Multiple Calls to 911 Made Prior to Girl's Death Are Released." And that was by Ray Covarrubias, Jr. We're going to move on now to national and world news with articles from USA Today. We'll start with 2 front page articles, one on the Israeli military and Gaza, and the second on the cherry industry in Michigan. The first article is entitled, "Israeli Military Set to Relocate Gaza Residents." The subtitle is, "We'll be moved to south as offensive is planned." This is by Mayan Lubel and Inas Alashre. Gazan residents will be provided with tents and other shelter equipment starting from August 17th, ahead of relocating them from combat zones to the south of the enclave to ensure their safety, the Israeli military said on August 16th. This comes days after Israel said it intended to launch a new offensive to seize control of northern Gaza City, the enclave's largest urban center, in a plan that raised international alarm over the fate of the demolished strip, home to about 2.2 million people. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on August 10th said that before launching the offensive, the civilian population will be evacuated to what he described as safe zones from Gaza City, which he called Hamas's last stronghold. The shelter equipment will be transferred via the Kerem Shalom crossing in southern Gaza by the United Nations and other international relief organizations after being inspected by defense ministry personnel, the military said. A spokesperson for the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs expressed concern over Israel's plans to relocate people to southern Gaza, saying it would only increase suffering. But the UN body welcomed Israel's recognition that shelter is a desperate need and that tents and other shelter equipment will be allowed again into Gaza. The UN and its partners will seize the opportunity this opens, the spokesperson said. The UN warned on August 14th that thousands of families already enduring appalling humanitarian conditions could be pushed over the edge if the Gaza City plan moves ahead. Palestinian and United Nations officials have said no place in the enclave is safe, including areas in southern Gaza where Israel has been ordering residents to move to. The military declined to comment when asked whether the shelter equipment was intended for Gaza City's population, estimated at around 1 million people presently, and whether the site to which they will be relocated in southern Gaza would be the area of Rafah, which borders Egypt. Israel's defense minister, Israel Katz, said on August 16th that the plans for the new offensive were still being formulated. The Palestinian militant faction Islamic Jihad, an ally of Hamas, said that the military's announcement as part of a brutal attack to occupy Gaza City is a blatant and brazen mockery of international conventions. However, Israeli forces have already increased operations on the outskirts of Gaza City over the past week. Residents in the neighborhoods of Zaytun and Shajaya have reported heavy Israeli aerial and tank fire. Residents there have also reported explosions throughout the day, resulting from Israeli tank shelling against homes in the eastern parts of the neighborhoods. The Israeli military on August 15th said that it had begun a new operation in Zaytun to locate explosives, destroy tunnels, and kill militants in the area. The war began when Hamas attacked southern Israel on October 7, 2023, killing 1,200 people and taking 251 hostages, according to Israeli authorities, and 20 of the remaining 50 hostages in Gaza are believed to be still alive. Israel's subsequent military assault against Hamas has killed over 61,000 Palestinians, Gaza's health ministry says. It has also caused a hunger crisis, internally displaced most of Gaza's population, and left much of the enclave in ruins. Protests calling for a hostage release and an end to the war were expected throughout Israel on August 17th, with many businesses, municipalities, and universities saying they will support employees striking for the day. Negotiations to secure a U.S.-backed 60-day ceasefire and hostage release deal ended in deadlock in July, and mediators Egypt and Qatar have been trying to revive them. U.S. stops visitor visas from Gaza. Meanwhile, the U.S. State Department on August 16th said it was halting all visitor visas for individuals from Gaza while it conducts a full and thorough review, a move that has been condemned by pro-Palestinian groups. The department said a small number of temporary medical humanitarian visas had been issued in recent days, but did not provide a figure. The United States issued more than 3,800 B1, B2 visitor visas, which permit foreigners to seek medical treatment in the United States, to holders of the Palestinian Authority travel document so far in 2025, according to an analysis of monthly figures provided on the department's website. That figure includes 640 visas issued in May. The PA issues such travel documents to residents of the Israeli-occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip. The department's website did not include a breakdown for the two territories. The State Department's move to stop visitor visas for people from Gaza comes after Laura Loomer, a far-right activist and an ally of President Donald Trump, said on social media on August 15th, that the Palestinian refugees had entered the United States this month. Loomer's statement sparked outrage among some Republicans, with Representative Chip Roy of Texas saying he would inquire about the matter, and Representative Randy Fine of Florida describing it as a national security risk. The Council on American-Islamic Relations condemned the move, saying it was the latest sign of the intentional cruelty of the Trump administration. The Palestine Children's Relief Fund said the decision to halt visas would deny access to medical care to wounded and sick children in Gaza. This policy will have a devastating and irreversible impact on our ability to bring injured and critically ill children from Gaza to the United States for life-saving medical treatment, a mission that has defined our work for more than 30 years, it said in a statement. And that article is entitled Israeli Military Set to Relocate Gaza Residents. That was by Mayan Lubel and Inas Alashre. Now, our second front page article from USA Today is entitled Michigan's Cherry County Feels Squeeze. The subtitle is Industry Deals with Trump's Changes to Government Services, Immigration, Trade. This is by PJ Huffstutter. The frost came in late April, sliding across the hills before dawn. Juliet King McAvoy stepped into the orchard, hoping the cold had spared the cherry buds, but they glittered in the morning sun like glass, just as dead. Weather had damaged much of the family orchard's crop for the third time in 5 years. The blow landed on a farm and an industry already squeezed by the Trump administration's changes to government services, immigration, and trade policies. King Orchard's harvest crew from Guatemala arrived in mid-July, shorthanded and weeks late after delays in securing the H-2A seasonal farmworker visas they rely on each year. They paid more to ship fresh cherries by private carrier after a U.S. Postal Service reorganization left fresh fruit sitting a bit too long. A U.S. Department of Agriculture grant request for funding a cold storage unit remained in limbo as Washington cut spending on farm programs and agricultural research. And Jack King, Juliet's brother and the farm's agronomist, kept searching for fertilizer cheap enough to haul and untouched by President Donald Trump's trade wars. "It all slows us down," King McAvoy, the farm's business manager, said during a brief pause in July's harried harvest. Farmers in the hills near Grand Traverse Bay, where the fruit of their labor has filled pies and fed generations, said they are caught in the crosshairs of Trump's reshaping of government, with sharp cuts and increasing delays hitting the $227 million U.S. tart cherry industry hard. From weather, plant disease, and pest woes, the USDA forecasts Michigan will lose 41% of its tart cherry crop this year compared to 2024. Northwest Michigan, where the King farm is located, faces the steepest drop, about 70%, according to the Cherry Industry Administrative Board. After the April freeze, King McAvoy's phone rang. It was her friend and fellow grower Emily Mizio in Suttons Bay, Michigan. "What are you seeing?" Juliet stared at the trees. "I'm not sure, but it's not good." South of the Kings, the cold snap left farmer Don Gallagher's trees sparse. "We can grow leaves," he said, as his family hunted for fruit in the branches. "We just can't grow cherries." Politics and tariffs. Michigan's cherry roots run deep, from French settlers bringing the fruit to the Midwest. The Montmorency, ruby red and mouth puckering, became the region's signature in pies, juice, dried fruit, and the syrup Midwesterners spoon over cheesecake. When John King bought the farm in 1980, cherries were a Michigan birthright, like cars. He grew up in a General Motors family in Flint, working summers picking fruit. "It felt pure," said King, now 74. He secured 80 acres of land with help from the federal loan. The roadside stand came with a preacher's warning painted on the sign, "Repent lest you perish in the fires of hell." He covered it with a rainbow and his dream, King Orchards. Today, it's a full family operation. In addition to John's daughter Juliet and son Jack, John's wife Betsy runs the market with Jack's wife Courtney. John's brother Jim manages the harvest. Jim's wife Rose is a chief baker, and their son-in-law Mark Schiller runs the handpick crews. Antrim County, where the farm sits, has long leaned Republican. The Kings, who are progressives, say the past few years have shown how national politics can ripple through their orchards. Trump's sweeping tax and spending law expanded safety nets for large commodity crop operations, such as corn and soybeans, for feed and biofuels. But nutrition and local food programs that fruit and vegetable growers depend on were slashed, and his trade policies chilled demand from top export partners, according to government data and academic researchers. While the USDA did not answer Reuters' specific questions regarding challenges facing the cherry industry, a spokesperson said Trump's law boosts the farm safety net and includes increased funding for programs that support specialty crops and fight plant pests and diseases. The Kings and nearly a dozen other farmers across party lines told Reuters they expected tariffs to return if Trump won, but they hoped for a more surgical approach. About one-third of the King's concentrate goes overseas, mostly to Taiwan and New Zealand. But Michigan's crop loss will play a bigger role in diminished tart cherry exports than tariffs this year, the Kings and other growers said. The White House did not comment on questions about the administration's trade policy. Asked about delivery delays, the USPS said it had a plan to save $36 billion over 10 years that would mean slightly slower delivery for some mail but faster service for other customers. Shrinking exports and budgets. While Michigan orchards struggle to fill bins, branches are bending in the West, with Washington State's sweet cherry production 29% bigger this year due to favorable weather, the USDA forecast. But growers there face different woes, fewer places to sell, and low prices. In 2024, the United States exported nearly $506 million in fresh cherries worldwide, up 10% in value and 3% in volume from the year before, U.S. Census Bureau trade data shows. In the first half of this year, as Trump's trade wars reignited, U.S. fresh fruit exports fell 17% in volume and 15% in value. That is all the time that we have for with this particular article from USA Today on the Michigan cherry industry. It is entitled, Michigan's Cherry County Feels Squeeze. That was by PJ Huffstetter. And that concludes the first hour of the Arizona Republic for August 17th, 2025. This has been Carrie, your volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. Now, if you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcastinfo and audio/on-demand. You can also take Sun Sounds with you. You can get our stream and on-demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. Now, please stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic.